Anderson heaving one down the sideline, and he's got Cass Allen.
Listening to the Bruin Bible. This is your host, Will Decker, bringing you UCLA football content all throughout the year for LA Football Network.
What is up, LAFB fans? Will Decker, your host from the Bruin Bible, and draft is in session. We are here to talk about Bet Online and the good people behind the brand. Football season is officially back, and Bet Online remains your number one source for all your football betting needs this season. You'll find the latest odds, matchup info, player needs, and game trends. And as your continued source for all sports wagering info, BetOnline features live betting, free contests, live scores, and giveaways all season long. Always the fastest and easiest way to bet all of your favorite sports and events like MLB, MMA, tennis, boxing, and even golf. Head to betonline.ag to join and receive your 100% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Make sure to use promo code LAFB to receive your rewards. Bet Online, where the game starts. What is up and welcome to a brand new edition of the Bruin Bible. We got a very special edition today. I got my two buddies from the Pac-12 Network. Worked with them last year in what we call as the bullpen. Editing your favorite highlights for the network. Getting the content that the people want out to the masses. I got Kevin Borba, Stanford writer for SI, in the building, and former Stanford defensive tackle Jordan Watkins. What is going on, fellas? I will start with you, Jordan.
Well, my God, what's going on, man? No, everything's good. Still up in the bullpen, making things happen. Basketball season starting. We just had media days up there. So been, a mix of, still cutting and supervising things for football and basketball. Of course, the Warriors have just started, so a little all over the place, but no, everything's good.
Love to hear it. Keeping that arm warm in the bullpen. Kevin Borba in the cut. Our guy following Stanford, first year down at the farm. Kind of tell me your thoughts, man. That's such an awesome step forward to be covering Stanford. How have you been liking it so far?
It's been a great experience. I feel like the Stanford community has they're a very interesting community, not like most college fan bases out there. They're, when I'm walking through the parking lots, they're pregame and sipping some Merlot. Like they're fancy out there, and they welcome me with open arms. And I've had a great time. You laugh, but it's true. I've seen more pregame wine bottles than I've seen pregame beers.
Well, that's why I'm laughing, because I know it's true.
My uncle, he tailgates before every Stanford game, and you're spot on with that, dude. You'll see guys out there, there's like cocktail bars. It's not even like just your typical Natty Light or Bud Light like you'll go to in the South, the Midwest, things like that. It's like this is a 1974 rosé that has not been released to the public. But it's kind of like that type of, pre-gaming for a football experience. Stanford's going to Stanford, man. That's the way they look at it. That's why they get, some of the top recruits, coming out over the last decade plus to come in there, because that's the pedigree they bring to the table. And just knowing your guys' Stanford ties, I thought you guys would be the perfect people to bring on to, preview this UCLA-Stanford game. It was a really fun one last year. Dorian Thompson-Robinson kind of had the game that propelled him to where he is now, or a guy that's, maybe looking at all Pac-12 second or third team this year after a huge win, against Stanford last year that led to a 9-game winning streak. Obviously, we lost last week to a very, very talented Oregon team, but they're looking to get back on track against Stanford. So just want to give the people kind of an update with this. And I'm going to go to Kevin on this one because, Jordan, I know you played for David Shaw. I know you got relationships there. I don't want to, mix anything up with our guy, D. Shaw. But, Kevin, our guy, as Jordan turns off the camera, David Shaw, 82 wins in his first 8 years at the helm. Only 24 losses. That's, he's averaging more than 10 wins, a season when it comes to that. Since then, since 2018, he's been 14-23 at the helm of Stanford. Some very, egregious defenses, some really tough, run games and injuries there, despite some talented players. Davis Mills, has made the NFL, things like that. Give me your thoughts on David Shaw and where he stands in the hot seat, because I think, for me personally, this is a guy that rightfully deserves it after such an incredible start, making things going for Stanford. I think it was 5 of 6 of his first years were at New Year's Bowls.
Yeah, honestly, David Shaw is in an interesting predicament, and I think Stanford as a whole is in an interesting predicament just because, one, David Shaw is very loyal to his coordinators, and he's very loyal to everyone that works with him. And I feel like the school is loyal to David Shaw, and he deserves that. He really does. You mentioned all of his accolades and stuff. He's a great college football coach, and I honestly think if you asked me this question 2 weeks ago, I would have said his seat was like really hot. But I think with the wins and the improvements that the team is showing, I think he's saving his job as each week goes on. But I do think that there's going to be a necessity for a coordinator change here or there, or changing who calls the plays, changing the playbook. They went to the slow mesh look on offense this year, and me and Jordan have talked about it on our podcast, probably weekly, and of how much we don't like it. we don't feel like they're playing to the strengths of the players that they have. They return this season, I think they were top five in returning production. And it just feels like they're not taking advantage of that. And you mentioned the injuries and stuff hurt. But I think David Shaw, I think he'll get a chance to adjust his coordinators before he gets the boot. I think he's earned that right as a really respected coach. I do think that his seat's a little warm just because, like you mentioned, when you haven't had a winning season since I think it's 2018, I think you have to kind of have those tough discussions because you need to see changes somewhere. And so I feel like if he makes those changes, then he deserves the right to kind of just take another swing at it, if you will.
Yeah, and 1-4 in conference to start, but those three of the four losses in conference, USC, Oregon, and Washington, who are all ranked within the top 18 right now. So it's not like he's losing to, you know, teams he should beat, I think, in those scenarios. Oregon State loss was obviously egregious, the 18 points let up in the fourth quarter. But, you know, I think he's had some success with that moving forward, as you mentioned, in the last 2 weeks. Whatever you want to make of Notre Dame this year, that's still a brand name that you can come out and beat. And then beating Arizona State, the thing that I've been impressed with the most is how the defense has responded to this, especially after that Oregon State loss. Have only allowed 14 points in each of the last two games, have really kind of stood out. So very impressive stuff from David Shaw on that. I want to flip the script too, because our guy, Tanner McKee. Tanner McKee came into this year as somebody that I was really looking at. If he played his cards the right way, this guy could be a legitimate first round prospect. And I've seen him kind of play it out here early, 10 touchdowns to 6 interceptions. And I know he's had some issues with the offensive line, not being fully healthy, but when you look at the weapons that this guy has, you know, for only 10 touchdowns and 6 interceptions, we were going through in the preseason who has the top receiving corps within the Pac-12. And when I look at what McKee has to offer, Michael Wilson, veteran receiver, you know, fifth-year senior in the offense. Elijah Higgins, a guy that had over 500 yards receiving last year. Very familiar veteran player in the offense. Tremaine, 5 touchdowns in 5 games last year. This guy was a legitimate threat out there on the football field making plays. And you got the likes of Benjamin Urosik, who we had as a top 10 tight end in the entire country coming this year. The only two tight ends I'd put ahead of him were Dalton Kincaid and Brent Keithy within the Pac-12 as a whole. And then John Humphreys, another veteran player coming out there. So when you have those weapons, for me, it's very confusing to see why he hasn't been able blowing up, at least statistically wise. And that may have to do something with the mesh scheme that you were talking about. Jordan, I'll start with you. I know Tanner McKee might be a first rounder to some, but for me on the outside, he's got all the weapons he needs. I just need to see a little bit more of it. What are your thoughts on McKee thus far this year?
So there's some context that goes to that too. I'll say it this way, like you mentioned Michael Wilson. Well, he's done for the year. There's already one gone. Bryson Tremaine, remember, he came off that very, very nasty leg injury, Oregon last year. And, you know, we're all Bay Area people or Bay Area fans. I mean, we can relate to this. Klay Thompson, right? He came off a torn ACL, then a torn Achilles. And, you know, I know obviously there's been this big thing lately. Charles Barkley said he's not his old self. I was like, yeah, you're not supposed to be yet. Like, duh. He came off 2 major injuries. Like, give him some time. And I think that's been the thing with Bryson Tremaine. You've kind of seen his production and just his explosiveness these last couple of weeks uptick, because now he's starting to get back to be comfortable. You're starting to see him have more trust in that leg again and be more himself. Also, you look at the run game, And not even just the run game, but the running backs in particular. Because, again, the thing with E.J. Smith and Casey Filkins now is that, you know, you're supposed to have two guys out the backfield that are supposed to be very helpful also in the pass game as well. Well, now both those guys are potentially out for the rest of the year. So that's been a big part of it. I know on paper it's like, yes, that they – the weaponry that Tanner McKee has – again, there's a reason why I was talking to Kevin about this a little earlier. There was a reason why I was pretty optimistic about Stanford offensively this year. And it hasn't worked out that way. Now, also at the same time, you know, if you want to look at some of the schemes offensively and like some of the route trees and concepts, like, yeah, you can do that too. Like, there are a lot of throws where Tanner's just got to throw it in a tight window. I mean, you look at a lot of what he does. It's a lot of back shoulders. It's a lot of jump balls. But every once in a while, though, you also see that throw that he makes in a tight window in a zone coverage. And it's like, whoa, that's that, you know, it's almost like the, oh my gosh, what's his name? It was in Django. It's like the meme where he's like pointing at the screen. Right. And it's kind of like it's like, no, that's the first round throw. That's it. He still shows it, you know, he still shows it. So, you know, it's nuanced and there's a lot of complexities that go into that. But no, I still think that overall, you know, I still think he's a first round talent. Cause I mean, again, even with the slow mesh, there's, you know, I've been on the fence about it, but I have said in, you know, recent weeks when they had a lot of offensive line injuries and we were playing in some road games and some tough road environments, you know, Washington, y'all both know I've said that that's the loudest place in the country. Oregon's right up there too. And those are places that they had to go with backup offensive linemen. So trying to get snap counts down and certain things like that with backup linemen, loud environments. And then you're already having a slow manufacturing offense. It's not an ideal recipe. So there it's a nuanced thing, but I'm still a big believer in Tanner McKee.
I'm a believer in McKee, and I think he's worthy of being drafted, maybe even like a day two pick. I just need to see that next level, you know, transition for me to go first round pick. This is the face of my franchise moving forward. I need a little bit more there. And the same goes for Anthony Richardson at Florida. It's like, I know he's got all the tools and you see the good stuff and you're like, wow, this guy has that ceiling to get there. But you break down the stats and it's like his interceptions are almost as much as his touchdowns. The decision making's not there. He's held Florida back in a lot of ways this year. And not saying McKee has, but just when you have that, you know, the receiving core of the experience with those guys, it's a little hard for me to put him as a first day guy. So, Kevin, give me your thoughts on Mr. McKee, because I like the kid. I really do. And I want to see him succeed. I just need to see a little bit more, you know, coming out of that.
Yeah, and I think Jordan was probably going to touch on this as well, too. It's like, I think Tanner McKee as a talent and as a prospect is everything that people are looking for in a quarterback these days. He doesn't really show it often, but he is kind of mobile. He shows every like
mobile 20 enough. Minutes.
Yeah, he'll like run and it's like, oh, he can move. But in terms of the offense, I feel like he's been somewhat limited by the offensive line play, the play calling. And because, like Jordan mentioned, they have these receivers and they're making Tanner throw into tight windows and like jump balls. And it's like they had tried to avoid using the middle of the field sometimes. And I feel like that's where some of their receivers are their best at. And then honestly, the thing that hurts Stanford, and we saw during the 4-game losing streak, or at least in the first 3 games, they're always in a lot of passing situations. And so it allows defenses to really just key in on what they're going to do because their offense is very predictable, which is why I think that there needs to be some sort of change this offseason in the offensive play call or whatever the offensive scheme is. It's just predictable. And so it's not really setting Tanner McKee up to succeed. I do think that the Oregon State game was probably his best game, efficiency-wise, stats-wise. He was lights out. He was making good throws. He was throwing touchdowns, making smart throws. He had an interception at the end of the game, but that was kind of like they had just blown their lead with like 10 seconds left in the game. So obviously they had to force the issue, but I feel like they're not complimentary of themselves right now. Like, I feel like Stanford is not playing complimentary football. And I think every college football coach in the country preaches complimentary football and they're just not getting that. And so when you know Tanner McKee is going to have to throw the ball, you obviously can key in on who he's going to throw the ball to. And I also kind of think that they're not using the weapons properly. I've kind of been hammering in on that all season. Benjamin Jurasic, I think, should be targeted at least 10 times a game.
Should be in the conversation for the Mackey Award with the way.
But how would you target him though? That's also the question.
Right. Well, I mean, with their offense, I don't know, because it seems like he's more. He reminds me of George Kittle. Sometimes I feel like he's used more as a blocker than as a pass catcher or pass weapon. I honestly prefer when he runs like an out route or a slant or something, and they just let him make the play after the catch. We've seen it multiple times where it's a quick pass to him or Elijah Higgins, or even Michael Wilson was great at this, a quick pass to him and they make plays after. I think that's how you target him. I don't really think there needs to be like a complicated route tree for any of them, really. Just let them get into space and then they'll make something happen. Elijah Higgins was clocked at, it was this game last year, I think he was clocked at 23 miles per hour on a breakaway touchdown. So let these guys get into space and let Tanner McKee make these easier throws. And then the more difficult throws that we all know that he is capable of making will come.
It's funny that you mentioned George Kittle, because with the Elijah Higgins reference, he was the second. So on that throw, I know exactly what throw you're talking about. Mm-hmm. He was clocked as the second fastest receiver in NCAA football last year. Do you know who number one was?
Man.
Like I said, it's a 49ers reference, so that's my hint. It was Danny Gray. Danny Gray was number one.
Yeah. Our boy Danny Gray.
But,
Before the 49er hit clicked, I was going to guess Jameson.
Which is also a very good guess, but no, it was Danny Gray was number one. But, I mean, the thing when I talk about the route concepts is sometimes, you know, based off what routes other people run, that can help you scheme certain things open. You know, like, and it comes to a certain selflessness, and I know these Stanford guys, I know they're not selfish. You know, there are going to be certain times where you're going to have to run that nine route or that deep post, the seven, just because you're not going to get the ball. It's to make sure something else underneath comes open, right? Like, you had to make the defense confused and think like that. That's more so what I'm talking about. You know, I want to see a little bit more with some of the concepts and help some of those guys get open. Don't make every single throw that Tanner has to make, you know, the tight seam route to Jurasic. Because remember, that's what happened. That was one of the picks he threw in the USC game, right? USC has that 6'6 middle linebacker. He sat on the seam route to Jurasic, tipped it in the air, and it got picked off. Yeah. So that's what I mean by that.
Yeah, and I mean, to your credit, you mentioned just the amount of times that Tanner McKee is throwing the football. He's thrown it 95 times the last two games. Like, the run has been taken away completely. And that's the next guy I want to transition to. Jordan kind of alluded to it earlier. I'm watching first couple weeks of football. Saturday's religious experience watching college football. One of the best things you can do.
Amen.
EJ Smith. I'm watching the 87-yard run against Colgate. SC game. It's appointment viewing for someone out here in Los Angeles. So we're watching that game. EJ Smith is off to a hot start, and it came down to some Stanford, you know, turnovers in the red zone, but they were very much neck and neck to start that game against the likes of a very talented USC team that currently ranks in the top 10. EJ Smith unfortunately gets injured, and was just such a big blow to fans of football in the Pac-12, because I thought this guy was really going to generate a lot of interest, a lot of fun plays to kind of continue moving forward. And then you couple that with Casey Philikins, who, you know, is a very solid, you know, running back number two within this conference. Doesn't provide the flash that EJ Smith does. You know, he's not going to take an 87-yard play to the house, but very solid, you know, does his job, comes in, can move the chains in certain situations. He is now out. So coming into this game, you guys have a banged up offensive line. The running back room is now down to its third running back. Kind of give me your thoughts on EJ Smith and just how this whole running back room as a whole has kind of transpired throughout the year. I'll start with you, Kevin.
Yeah, and EJ Smith, they lost two players, if you will. One, they lost a great running back who could, like you said, take it to the house every time he touched the ball. He was honestly, before he went out, I think he was statistically their best pass catcher in terms of most catches at that time, or he was towards the lead in pass catches. And like, I think they were going to move him around a lot, and they kind of lost like a chunk of their offensive scheme when they lost CJ Smith. They had a lot of plans for him, which rightfully so. It's hard not to use a weapon like that. But yeah, losing him, they kind of, you could probably say they ripped like 20 pages out of the playbook. If there was an actual book of paper, like it just ripped 20 pages out, because like Casey Filkins, really hard runner, power runner. Like you said, he's not really a big play threat. Ironically, I think he got hurt on the one time he unleashed a big play this past weekend, was when his arm got hurt on that late hit. But they don't really have a big play player in the backfield anymore, which really hurts them. And then it forces McKee to throw the ball, like you mentioned, 90 whatever times in the past two games.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And you look back at the identity of the David Shaw teams. It's we run the ball and we play stout defense. And this goes back to the likes of Stephen Taylor, Tyler Gaffney, obviously the Christian McCaffreys, the Bryce Loves, these type of running backs that really set the tone for the David Shaw teams. And I think he finally found that back after a couple of years of not really having the feature back that he wanted back there with E.J. Smith. And it was such a crushing blow moving forward for Stanford. Jordan, E.J. Smith out. Filikins was at least doing a serviceable job. He is now gone. Where does Stanford go from this? And give me your thoughts as a former player just watching E.J. Smith take the top off on a freaking defense.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing for me was – he was, in my opinion, the best pass catcher out the backfield since that Stanford's had since Christian. He was the best one. But also, not even just that, it's you had to look at the whole totality of skill players that they had coming into the year. That's what made it so exciting. Because even, you know, thinking about the last Rose Bowl year we had when Christian was there, you know, obviously you had a really good quarterback, an established quarterback, Kevin Hogan. You had a really good deep threat with Michael Rector. You had a really big receiver that could be a deep threat or also do things underneath and Devin can juice. You had a really good tight end in Austin Hooper. Like, I can go on and on. You also had a really, really good offensive line. Like, think who was on that offensive line. Andrews Pete was your left tackle. He's a Pro Bowl guard with the Saints. You had Josh Garnett, who was a first overall pick for the 49ers. You had – I'm trying to think.
Kyle Murphy.
We'll keep going. Kyle Murphy was there, who's also had his time in the NFL too. I think he was with the Packers for a good bit. So, but you look at that, you saw a lot of similarities with what this offense was supposed to be this year too, right? I mean, obviously we talked about the skill group and things like that. And so going forward, obviously, you know, it hasn't gone the way we would hope because the injury to the offensive line, Michael Wilson's out for the year, EJ's gone, now Casey's gone. I told Kevin this earlier, I think the best running back Stanford can have is their offensive line. I really think that, again, especially going into this game where you know you're going up against such a potent offense, the best thing that you can do is keep them off the field as long as possible. And the way you do that will simplify the game for your running backs. Don't have to make them make this type of read or that read. Don't make them have to make this big type of fancy play. Just open up the simple hole, let them make the simple read, and then, you know, let their instincts take over from there, right? Like maybe you break this one tackle and all of a sudden the 3 or 4 yard runs turns into a 6 or 7 yard run. That's what they need to do. It really all depends up to the offensive line. You have to stay ahead of the sticks. You know, 1st and 10 can't turn into 2nd and 9 or 2nd and 8. And then that can't turn into 3rd and 7. Like it needs to be 2nd and 6, 2nd and 5. And then, you know, 3rd and 3, things like that. That's what needs to happen.
Which that's what they lost with Smith, because he was averaging 7 yards a carry. And so he was like a guarantee, or not a guarantee, but it was almost like within two plays you had a first down.
Without a doubt. But also keep in mind the two defenses he went against, right? Well, one was Colgate, which also was kind of skewed by a 80-plus yard touchdown run.
Right.
And then, like we talked about, USC's defense, as good as USC is,
their defense,
not because they're a stout defense, because they thrive off turnovers.
That's true.
We talked about they were living. Stanford lived in the red zone in that game. They just didn't capitalize.
Right. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, when you look back at the recruiting trends that Stanford has had, their highest recruits, I'd be willing to bet like 5 of their top 7. They put all their emphasis into the offensive line because they know it starts in the trenches. You know, your Walker Littles, your Drew Dahlmans, your people like that. That is who Stanford football has been for the last decade plus when it comes to recruiting guys. So I agree with you. It does start with the offensive line. If the offensive line is, you know, clicking, you know, coming into this year, I think the unit had a combined 114 career starts together. If they're healthy, if they're out there on the field, that makes a huge difference for Stanford, particularly the run game. And that will open up the pass for a guy like Tanner McKee, who we know has the tools to move forward with that. Going to the wide receiver room, we kind of delve into a little bit. I want to get your guys' take because I feel like there's four or five really solid playmakers when it comes to Stanford within this field. And Wilson has kind of been the go-to target for McKee this year, but I want to get some honest opinions from both of you. It's third and nine. Let's say the game's on the line. You got to get a first down. Who is the guy you're going to, and who should UCLA be most worried about, you know, in the wide receiving game? I'm going to start with you on this one, Jordan.
Where is the ball? How much time's left? I like
39, so... 35 yard on like you're on the UCLA 35 yard line. Like they UCLA got 35.
Okay. So, well, there's, obviously, unfortunately, like there's no Michael Wilson anymore.
This is where Stanford struggles.
Right here, middle of the field, past midfield.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, like going towards the red zone, like that's where their struggle has been. But I would say, you know, in terms of your best physical mismatch, it's going to be Elijah Higgins. But in terms of, you know what, it might get a little messy and murky. You might need someone to make that catch in traffic. I know it's technically not in the wide receiver room. You got to find a way to get Urosik the ball. Like that, that's how I'm thinking. But I mean, in terms of like just your bet, like, and this is what I'm saying in terms of, you know, certain concepts, right? Because all different guys have so many good skill sets. I think Elijah Higgins is probably your best in terms of making something happen after the catch, right? So maybe if the numbers game is right on one side, you know, maybe it's a 2v2, boom, if one receiver gets a block, you just throw something quick out to Higgins, he can make that one person miss. If it's something in the middle, you think the seam's going to be there, and it's like, hey, the safety's going to come down, you need to make this catch, it's your Urosik. If it's, you know what, it's going to be one-on-one, I trust you to make this catch over anybody else, it's going to be Bryson Tremaine. Like it really just depends on, like, you know, what's going on. But overall, I would say, you know, look for your Urosik.
It's like having a Ferrari in the garage and just not letting it out. It's I do not understand how you guys do not target Urosik. Watching film on this guy last year, I mean, we're in the offices. I have to watch these games, whether we like it or not, at the Pac-12 on a Saturday. I'm watching Urosik. I'm like, this guy is a baller, dude. Like, you know, Greg Dulcich was a stud for UCLA last year. Yes. But outside of Dulcich and a few others, I'm looking at Urosik, like, this guy's returning next year, too. This guy is going to be the face of the Pac-12 when it comes to the tight end position. Who knows? He may end up being a finalist for the Mackey Award. Through a couple games, 28 catches, 250 yards, zero touchdowns in the year. The zero touchdowns, you can use this guy in the red zone. I hope your offensive coordinators know that, because this is what needs to happen with a guy like Urosik. Very similar to Kittle, Kevin, because – the 49ers fans, I think the number one complaint they have with the offense, outside of maybe a Jimmy Garoppolo-like player, is give George Kittle the ball.
Don't get me started on the 49ers. Don't get me started. You don't want to hear that conversation.
Hey, man. I know he is a damaged Falcons fan. We love him to death. As a Kyle Shanahan apologist, we apologize for what happened. But we understand, my man.
You don't know how happy that win made me feel 2 weeks ago. You have no idea.
Mariota torched us, dog. That is an ass kicking. I don't think he completed one pass that day. Is that correct?
It was like 13 or 14, but we beat the 49ers in their own game. We bullied them. We out physical them.
Yeah. We had like 7 of our 11 defensive starters out. But
we have $80 million in dead cap space. But top 3 of our defensive backs are out. Like, I mean, we can play the excuses game back and forth if you want.
While I'm at it too, we're talking about lack of targets to Kittle and Urosik. Give my guy Kyle Pitts the football. Like, please.
Yeah. I don't disagree, but you know what? Part of that, again, comes down to quarterback play. How much do you trust your quarterback? Which I think this is one thing that Falcons fans and 49er fans can agree with, right? It's, yeah, of course, you want this person and this person and this person to get all these targets. But sometimes, because, I mean, even the game before we played the 49ers, right, we played the Browns. And there was one drive, we ran the ball 14 straight times. Because it's like, you know what? Marcus is just not at this game. Let's take the ball out of his hands. We trust what we can do. And they won that game. And that's like that's where the Falcons are right now. But I will say this, if they win on Sunday, they're in first place in the NFC South.
Boy, that is NFC South is brutal right now. I gotta say that. That is a rough, rough division. NFC West ain't much better, I gotta be honest.
No.
But you said
shout out Geno Smith, by the way.
Ooh, he's cooking right now. Let Geno cook. That's the real chef in the kitchen there, if I may do say so myself.
Hey.
The let Russ cook thing is, ooh, that is aging pretty rough right now.
If you let Jimmy cook, you might get some unseasoned chicken.
Well, I was about to say, you go, Marcus Mariota didn't have it that day. I go, oh, I can relate. My quarterback never has it any day of the week. So that was where I was going to go with that. Kevin Borba, I'm going to pity you the same question.
Okay.
3rd and 9, game on the line. You need a first down, move the sticks. You got to go to one guy. You know, when you think of Kansas City, that's Mahomes to Kelsey. When you think of Buffalo, that's Allen to Diggs. Who is McKee's guy in that situation and why?
Honestly, I feel like there's not really a wrong answer, but I actually would go with Bryson Tremaine. And I tweeted this during the Arizona State game. I tweeted death, taxes, and Bryson Tremaine catching contested jump balls.
Yes.
Because I think you could throw the ball up to him, and I just feel more confident in him coming down than the defender. He's really, like Jordan said, he's been hitting his stride lately. He's got 11 catches in the past 3 games compared to 6 in the first 3. And so I think you got to go Tremaine. I feel like he just gives you the most jump catch ability. And I would like to say Higgins is the right answer, but just based off of how the offense uses him, I don't know if he's getting that chance to be out in open space. And then Jurosic is probably on the line blocking. So by process of elimination, I think you got to go Tremaine. Also, I feel like UCLA's DBs like to get a little chippy, a little physical. And so, you know, maybe that's Tremaine's strong suit. I think he likes when people try to out physical him.
Yeah. And the thing that scares us as UCLA, you know, people that cover UCLA and follow the team, is the secondary has been the weak point for Chip Kelly, no matter any year it has been. You look at the numbers, they've ranked sometimes in the hundreds when it comes to pass defense and yards allowed, you know, yards per play, things like that. You guys have the talent level of receiving position. We've gone over it. We've talked about it in depth to make this secondary, you know, real, you know, kind of like what we saw last week with Oregon. And that's scary. When you're talking about 3 different guys on a 3rd and 9 situation, usually it's one guy when you think of in that moment. Mm-hmm. You guys have 3 different guys coming to me on this. That is what would make a UCLA team very scary, you know, coming into a game like this. So a lot to be worried about on the receiving room for Stanford. Want to move to the defensive side of the football. Jordan, this is your specialty. It's only right we start with you on the defensive line. This team, you know, they have done a reasonable job of getting after the passer. They're 4th in the Pac-12 in sacks this year, only behind the likes of USC, Washington, and Washington State with 18 on the season. Stephen Heron's making some moves out there, 4.5 sacks on the year. They got some blitzers coming off the edge. You know, outside linebacker, I'm looking at Ricky Mizon, I believe his name is. They've got some stuff. They're bringing the pressure. That hasn't been a problem, I would say. What have you seen from this front 4 and blitzing schemes that Stanford has provided?
Well, I mean, early on it was a problem. You know, I think, and part of that was, you know, they've been making this transition to a 4-3 front. You know, traditionally for the last 10 years plus, we were a 3-4 defense. And they finally decided to make the decision to change it. There were a lot of reasons for that. One of the big ones, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, Will, I know you do your research in your home. You've probably already seen it. There aren't that many big bodies up front for Stanford.
No.
You know, like back in my day, we had guys like Terrence Stevens, David Perry, Harrison Phillips. Those are those guys, those big body guys that could be nose guards up front and then make it work with that. And they don't have that anymore. So they made the switch. And I think that, you know, when you make a schematic switch like that, it takes time. And now I think these last couple of weeks, you started to see some, not even just some of the blitzes, but also some of those games that you do up front, they've started to really get home. You know, like I think, you know, for example, it's just like, again, to go back to our Bay Area ties, you look at the Warriors. You know, I think everyone thinks of a pick and roll as like an easy play. But it's a little bit more nuanced than that, right? And one of the things that we've now seen with, you know, a little bit more time under their belt and training camp and all those things, that they have a pretty good pick and roll relationship is Jordan Poole and James Wiseman. But it took time for that to grow. And I think for some of these games and some of these stunts up front, it has taken time for some of those Stanford defensive linemen to really understand how this is going to look, who's going to be where, how they're going to, you know, make this pick, that pick, things like that. But now it's starting to come to fruition. So I think that's been like the real big difference these last couple of weeks.
And Heron, the guy that I mentioned, 3 sacks in the last 2 games, has really kind of come alive. 2 in that Notre Dame game alone. And outside of the 1 sack he had against ASU, was generating a lot of pressure off the edge. I think sack numbers, you know, I think they are important stats, but it can be inflated at times.
Absolutely.
If you're getting 7 to 8 pressures a game, making the quarterback's job hard on those 7 to 8 plays a game, that is a very, very solid game from a defensive end. Getting in the backfield, making things difficult. Kevin, pose you the same question, man. Defensive line, what have you seen from Stanford? And in the last 2 weeks, they've really kind of taken a step up, you know, adjusting to this new scheme.
Yeah, honestly, I think, and this is probably my favorite stat about this Stanford defense, is when they hold their opponent's rushing attack to 160 yards or less, they are 3-0. And when the opposing team rushes for over 160 yards, they're 0-4. I feel like that's a perfect representation of where this team is at. They've obviously greatly improved. I think the Notre Dame game was more of a testament to it than the ASU game, just because Notre Dame's running backs are really good, both of them in their own right. Not that Arizona State's running backs aren't good. It's just I think the Notre Dame ones were really high class. But, yeah, I think, like Jordan said, they're getting a lot of pressure from a lot of people. We saw Ernest Cooper, who's their freshman 4-star. He made his first – I believe it was his first appearance all season, unless he appeared and didn't register a stat. But he made his first appearance against Arizona State and got – a sack, 2.5 tackles for a loss, 5 total tackles. And I think you're just seeing this defense play a lot tougher. And that was, I forgot who spoke after the game to the media from the defensive side. Who was it? I forgot who spoke to us, but they said that their focus was on being more physical and like more tough and less selfish and more selfless. Like everybody's just trying to make a play and they're trying to be more physical like the Stanford defenses of the past. And then I was also told, I want to say it was before the Notre Dame game, I guess they reached out to former players and they were kind of seeing like what they need to do to improve. And I guess,
oh, they did.
They were trying to see, or I forgot who they asked, but they were basically, the message was they need to be Stanford tough, and they weren't being Stanford tough. And we've seen it each and every game. We saw against Oregon was the first time that I personally saw it. They're starting to get chippy, post play shoving, post play, like jawing at each other. And the Stanford defense, I think if you like erased the first 6 or 7 weeks and just looked at them from this like 2 week perspective, you would probably say that they're one of the better defenses in the Pac-12. I think that's fair to say just based off these last 2 week performance or 2 weeks of performance. So I think they're really hitting their stride, and I look forward to see if they could stop the rushing attack that is UCLA, because you guys obviously have the best running back in the conference and a quarterback that I like to say can scoot with the best of them.
I will say this, you know what also helps you though play that much more physical and that much more fast is you don't have to think about what's going on. And so, again, that's why I'm saying I think the fact that now, you know, they're in the middle of the year with this adjustment, with, you know, the 4-3 adjustment, I think that's been a big part of it too.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I do got to side with Kevin on this. The run defense, and I know you guys are adjusting schemes. We've been over that. The run defense has not been great this year. I think we can all agree on that. They're 112th or tied for 112th in the nation in the amount of rushing yards per game they're giving up. And they're averaging 5.21 yards a carry giving up on the defense. When you bring in a guy like Charbonnet in, who, for my opinion, is a bull, and this guy needs to be in the Doak Walker Award watch list because this dude can flat-out ball with the best of them. You know, we're looking at you, Bijan Robinson. We're looking at the top dogs. This guy can ball. So we're excited about our guy Charbonnet. And there's a scenario where I think he can come alive this weekend. And, you know, this would be a 200-plus yard rushing performance that would kind of get him a little bit higher on the Doak Walker Award list and things of that nature. rush defense. How do we fix this? I'm going to go back in reverse order. Kevin Borbell, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, honestly, in terms of how to fix it, they just have to mix things up front. I think they have to disguise blitzes really well. They have to have some, not only do they need to like channel some great stunts, but they need the stunts to work. I don't know. It's really hard to stop Charbonnet and DTR just because they both pose such a threat running. Charbonnet really, I think you have to make his life hard from the get-go. And I think you kind of have to make Chip Kelly take him out of the playbook himself, like maybe make UCLA uncomfortable or not feel confident in the run and kind of take their own run game out of the game itself and just hope that you can kind of defend the pass, which, I mean, DTR is passing at an unreal rate this year. I think he's second is what we decided, Jordan, in completion percentage.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of like a pick your poison with this team. And so I really think you have to just sell out on the run and just make them pass. I think that's what I would do. I don't know. I think Jordan would probably have more in-depth on what a defensive lineman would do, but I feel like you either got to sell out to the pass or sell out to the run.
Make them choose. Make it hard for them. Take away their star players, if you will, from an NBA perspective. Make the other guys kind of get involved. Mr. Yeah. Waddy, what do we do with this run defense? How do we make it improve?
I feel like that's a really good way to put it, because, I mean, I think, again, it's, you know, when I was talking about from a pass rush standpoint in terms of the games and things that they do, the same thing is true on run plays. I thought at the beginning of the year what I was going to see a lot more of when they switched to 4-3 with some of these smaller defensive linemen, a lot more stunts, let them move, try to penetrate gaps. Because the thing is, at the end of the day, you know, with Chip Kelly and a lot of what he wants to do with that zone scheme coming downhill, one of the big things you can do up front to kind of slow that down is if you have penetration, right? Don't let Charbonnet get going, because obviously, as we all know, once he gets going, I mean, we saw this back when he was at Michigan. You know, once he gets going, he is a hard dude to stop. So if you can make him kind of, you know, stop his feet a little earlier on before he can get to that and then let guys rally, that's what you need to do. And then, you know, at that point, once they get behind the sticks, you know, it's now those stunts that you do in the run, they got to convert over to the pass games now, right? Like, get home, still stay true to your responsibilities. We see how dangerous DTR can be when he's outside the pocket. So if you're rushing him, you know, again, if you're the end, you've got contained, rush the upfield shoulder. Don't let him bounce outside and bubble outside. And, yeah, like, keep him in that pocket, because, I mean, like we're talking about, you know, probably at the end of this year, we're going to see DTR being at the top of all the big UCLA categories. Sorry, Kate McNown, but that's the case. DTR is probably going to be at the top of all the passing categories in UCLA history. And so, since he's going to be good in that regard, don't let him beat you in the other way, right? Like, I mean, again, I know we've made some NFL crossovers. Well, if you had a choice, do you want to let Lamar Jackson beat you running and throwing, or do you want him to try to beat you throwing? Josh Allen's the same way. Jalen Hurts the same way. Like, all those top guys, it's the same thing with DTR. How do you want to beat you? I would, like, trust me, he's a good throwing quarterback, but I would much rather him try to beat me just throwing than try to beat me running and throwing.
Yeah, totally fair. And the efficiency has been kind of the thing that has stood out to us among UCLA fans. It was a long development for him. You know, he was
100%.
He was a high school wide receiver at Bishop Gorman when Tate Martell was there. So he had to convert back to quarterback as a senior. So he's only really had 6 years of playing quarterback full time. And just the athletic nature this guy possesses and how he could take the top off the defense. I know Stanford fans remember last year when he ran it in from about 45, 50 yards for a touchdown within that game. He was balling, man. So DTR, a lot of great things there. Here's the last thing we got for you guys. What is your final score prediction of the Stanford-UCLA game this weekend? I will go in reverse order again. Jay Waddy, lead me off, brother.
All right, so Kevin knows this. I am now on this two-game streak where I pick against Stanford, and they've won, so I'm sticking true to that. So I'm going UCLA with this. I'm going to say 34-24. 34-20. UCLA. And again, I will say this though, like the opposite side of it is if Stanford has a chance, again, you control the clock, make this game as short as possible because of how dynamic and explosive that offense is, obviously on the other sideline of UCLA. But 34-20 Bruins.
Love to hear it. Kevin Borba, what do we got, brother?
Yeah, I'm going to go. I think UCLA wins this game. I just feel like Stanford's injuries at the running back position makes them a little too one-dimensional. And I talked about on our podcast with Jordan earlier, I'm just not confident with Tamar Key having to throw the ball as much as he does, or as much as he's going to throw the ball. So I'm going to go UCLA 42, Stanford 20. I just think it's going to be a tough one. I think it's going to be one of those games where all the wind in their sails and all the momentum that they had will kind of die right here. Well, die is a harsh word, but die right here.
Hey, man, I still think Stanford can really turn everything around. I think they had the majority of their tough schedule at the beginning of the season. I think this is a bowl-eligible team. You know, call me crazy. I think that's something that they can really lean into moving forward. But I'm kind of in Kevin's camp. There's just one thing that boils down. Poor rush defense, Charbonnet. It's just like, it's as simple as that. Feed the rock to Charbonnet. Sure. If he gets going early, I mean, we've seen it all year long. I mean, even against the number one rush defense within the conference last week at Oregon, this guy got 158 yards, a touchdown, 20 carries, 7.6 yards a carry on that front seven, you know, from the Oregon with the likes of Justin Flo, Brandon Dorless, DJ Johnson, like studs. Guys that are going to be playing at the next level. So I think there's a chance for Charbonnet to have a big first half. I'm probably going to go 42-20, I think would be my guess in this one. You know, I just think it could get out of hand a little early with Charbonnet. Another name to sprinkle in there, Jake Bobo.
For those familiar,
has been absolutely balling since we have gotten in Pac-12 play and deserves to be, you know, of mention in this conversation. Mr. Borba brought to attention his thoughts on Bryson Tremaine, the death taxes and big catches. With Jake Bobo, it's the same thing. It's, you know, the Washington game really stands out to me. He had five catches, 142 yards, and two touchdowns. Three of those catches came on third downs to move the chains, like big third downs, third and seven, third and nine, third and 12. And the other two were huge touchdown catches to advance them. So this man, the joke around UCLA circles, this man is incapable of making a non-important catch for UCLA. So Jake Bobo is the guy to watch out for in the offense. Defense, who knows what can happen there. They're trying to recover in a lot of different areas. That secondary, that front seven was manhandled by that Oregon offensive line. Want to give credit where it's due. That Oregon,
that's a different beast.
That was, I mean, you watched probably the video that I watched that Jeff Schwartz tweeted out, where it was 2.5 minutes of just ass boots to fucking pavement, dude. Just absolute ass kicking. Just unbelievable stuff.
I'd like to point out the only sack that they've given up was to Stanford.
Hey, man, there you go. That's what I was trying to hype up with that Stanford pass defense right there. I'm liking what I'm seeing. They're top four in the Pac-12. Here's the last official question. It has nothing to do with football. What have you been binge watching? This is kind of a new tradition we've been implementing into the Bruins Bible. Mr. Jordan Watkins, what have you been binge watching?
What have I been binge watching? That's a good question because, again, I'll be honest and open. I have no life. I don't watch much stuff outside of sports. So, honestly, I would just say I've just been binge watching football.
That's a reasonable answer.
I think that would be my answer. You know, obviously, y'all know what I do on Saturdays. I'm up there all day watching football. And then if I do have time off on Sundays, I'm watching football. So, I will say this, though. Like, since it came back, I can't binge watch it. Because, you know, it's like coming out on season. But y'all know the show All American?
Yeah. Yeah,
so their new season just started a few weeks ago. And then also the spinoff show, their new season started too. So I've been watching both of those lately.
Nice. I will say I really liked the first season of All American.
Yeah.
But it's just progressed for me personally. It's kind of got a little soap opera-ish, if I'm being honest.
So definitely is really extra. No,
we saw like the catalyst, the main character. We saw him running through drills in that one scene. You know what I'm talking about because Twitter is like stand this a million times over.
Yeah.
After I saw that scene, I was like, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. You know, I really liked All American. It was something I was into, but after that, I couldn't do it. But respect. You got to tell me what's going on, because the last thing I saw, some guy got shot, you know, girlfriend drama. Right. He's going to Toledo State or something like that, something like that. But yeah, really interesting show. Kevin Borba, what do you got for me?
Yeah, I'm unfortunately not on the All-American hype train, just because my girlfriend actually started watching it without me, so I just never really got into it. I got three shows. Peaky Blinders on Netflix. It's like a British mob show. It's probably the best show I've watched since Breaking Bad. In my personal opinion, me and my girlfriend are both enjoying Big Sky, which is a CW show, so it's a little dramatic, but it's solid. Little detective-y show. And then Home Economics on Hulu, which has been treating me well. Kind of a show to pass through the time.
Is that the one with Jimmy Tatro's on that?
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. It's about, he's like a really rich dude, and there's three siblings. He's really rich. The other one's like middle class, and the other one is they're like kind of middle class adjacent, but they have less money than the other two. And so, yeah, it's just a fun little family show. It's kind of funny. I just watch it to pass the time. But Peaky Blinders is a great show that everybody should watch. I recommend it.
I love it, dude. I have been saving House of Dragon. I have to like binge it in one sitting. So I am doing that for the majority of the weekend, fellas. My life, Jordan said he has a life where it's no life. My life is going to be very sad this weekend. Only football and just House of Dragon. That's pretty much it. So not a whole lot going on for Halloween weekend for Will Decker anymore. But
also, I was going to say, have y'all seen the Redeem Team documentary?
Oh, yes. Fantastic. Yeah,
that was great.
Oh, I liked it. I liked it, but I would have liked to see some more points of view besides the banana boat people.
Well, I agree with that, because I guess the thing for me was when they were building it up as like from the same producers that brought you, you know, what's the name of the Michael Jordan one?
Last Dance.
Last Dance. I was thinking like, all right, that means we're going to get 10 episodes or whatever of like looking into the Redeem Team, you know? And so like, so I guess to your point, it was like, yeah, I was thinking I was going to get that, but.
Yeah. I think I just had too high of expectations.
Which I did too. But at the same time, I think, you know, obviously like for our age group and well, even those above us and some below us, seeing Kobe in that regard, you know, like that was, I've talked to a lot of other people that have watched it, and like that was something that was really hard for them, just to, because I've forgotten honestly the whole timeline of like where he was in his career. Yeah.
In the league, like he was not liked at that time.
Yeah. No, not at all, not at all. I forgot that, and so. But also, I must say this, and you know, again, like we can have this basketball barbershop conversation another day, but the fact that it was like LeBron specifically that really made that effort of like, no, come on, you're one of us. Like, come on, dude. Come on. Like, no, that was really cool to see.
It was, man. And, you know, I'm a sucker for those Kobe videos because, in my opinion, there are better basketball players than Kobe Bryant to have ever existed. I'm not one of those stands that are going, you know, this and this, LeBron, you know, all those dudes. But in my opinion, I don't think anyone of notes at that level has worked harder at the game of basketball than Kobe. And, you know, it's no accident that the year after the Dream Team or the Redeem Team happens, you know, Carmelo's playing the Western Conference Finals. LeBron gets his first MVP. Dwayne Wade is on the shortlist for the MVP. They really saw the work ethic pour into.
They talked about it.
The club scene where they were coming.
They talk about the training camp in Vegas, right? They're coming back late night and it's like 4 a.m. And they see Kobe, he's already dripped in sweat. So I'm like, yeah, I'm about to go get another workout. And from there on, they're just like, okay, well, so much for, and trust me, I know Vegas. I love Vegas. So I know exactly where all those dudes were going. And they're like, yeah, you know what? Aria and Dre's and all these places. Yeah, we can't go there. Like I'm telling too much, but,
my guy Waddy, if you're going to Vegas, I've got a travel planner for you. He is to the right of me, this guy named Jordan Watkins. He gets you reservations at Dre's nightclub. He knows all the guys there. So if you're going to Vegas.
I didn't say I can get you reservations. I just said if we're there, though, I can definitely tell us where we need to go.
There you go. He's got him all right. He's got the Vegas secrets, man. I'm looking forward to potentially making that trip with the both of you guys at some point.
It's a must. Fellas, championship or something.
Let's, hey, you know I'm there. You know I'm there. Pac-12 championship, if UCLA is there, we will be there in person. But, fellas, just, like, great to see you guys, you know, co-workers, good friends at the very end of it. So, really love seeing you guys. Bruin Bible, we are officially –